time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to Capital Thinking. We're going to spend the first half hour of the show talking about presidential politics, what's wrong with Congress, and looking at some of the hot congressional races around the country. Joining us for this half hour, two of our esteemed political gurus, Nick Allard and Vince Verlici. Vince and Nick, welcome back, and let's start off with Republican politics and get your analysis of where things stand. Vince, tell us a little bit about where you think people see this race going on the Republican side as the primary season starts to loom in the next 60 days.
Well, it's quite an amazing primary. I mean, I think, you know, having looked at these poll numbers and the way it's developed, I mean, look, you know, it just seems like the Republican Party just keeps looking for a better prom date when they've got a candidate in former Governor Romney that is polling within 3 or 4 points of the president in head-to-head matchups.
I think there's some candidates who may not have gone to their prom, actually, Vince.
That's good. I think that the interesting thing is that you've got, per this Wall Street Journal NBC poll that came out today, 40% of the Republicans polled are enthusiastic about voting for Romney in the general, but 60% are not. And with Governor Perry having raised a significant amount of money while he's falling in the polls, he could use that money to attack Romney and really make this an unsettled time for what I think many thought in the last week was a time for Governor Romney just to lock this up and start moving to the general. So very unsettling time, I think, for that side of the ticket.
But having said that, I think you can phone it in. Not only is the field set now, but that Romney will be the nominee, and that the acceleration of the primary season, you know, plays to his strength, the fact that he's ahead, he's got the money, the resources, and the operations that I think that plays. So,
I'm not sure I buy it, though, because, you know, he's not contesting Iowa. Chances are still that a conservative wins the Iowa caucuses, and he's way ahead in New Hampshire, which is, you know, adjoining his home state, Massachusetts. But if you look at who polls, you know, whoever was leading, Nate Silver of the New York Times and 538.com had a great analysis of this. It basically argued that the people who were leading the race in the New Hampshire primary at this point in prior election cycles were never the person who won that primary.
Well, if I'm wrong, I'll buy a bucket of onion rings at P.J. Clark's on 16th Street facing the White House. But, you know, I think he actually, and then stepping back, whatever lack of excitement that there may be, he is a formidable candidate for the president, and that they're taking that very seriously. They have a little bit of an advantage in that they get to really focus their fire right now on him in the same way that all the Republicans at least should have been, but soon will be able to focus on Obama. I mean, they've been focusing on each other, scrambling, you know, for the top of the pile right now. But it's a very interesting development, and I think that he actually matches up very well against Obama.
Yeah, I think actually that's probably true. I do want to shift to Obama. And Vince, the president announced this morning, his campaign announced raising $70 million for the last quarter. That's the good news, way above their $55 million goal. The bad news is it's way below what they raised the first quarter out of the gate, and they essentially have to raise nine figures a quarter now to meet their initial fundraising expectations and public expectations that they might raise $750 million or $1 billion for this campaign. Is momentum slowing down for the president?
I don't think so. I mean, every fundraising plan looks that way. You pull the low-hanging fruit and the enthusiastic money from both the online folks and the bundlers quickly. The question for him is that how does he get those online folks to give that $50 or $100 a month for the next year? I mean, that's the interesting thing about his money so far, is it's been more heavily weighted towards the large donors, giving maximum checks of $35,000 and change at the DNC and $5,000 to the campaign versus the low-dollar donors. And that's been, I believe, part of, you know, some of their communication in the last month being more populist, is to try to get that base cooked up again. So I'm not concerned about his money. I mean, look, the RNC has only got $14 million cash on hand, and the president's doing 70 a quarter. Maybe it's 50, maybe it's 40, but that's – He's not gonna be for lack of money.
What do you think, Nick? Is Obama suffering from an enthusiasm gap out on the campaign trail?
I think it's not what he experienced the first time around for a lot of understandable reasons. It's not puppy love right now. I mean, it's not this embracing this great new enraptured idea. So he's been around. It's new. I think that the ease with which he attracted turnout with an excitement among young voters, among Hispanics, certainly, I'm not the last person in the world to be an expert on this, but the black community and other minorities and so on, is a challenge for him. And, I think the reception he got at the Congressional Black Caucus is very telling, where I was watching his speech and he was getting fired up and very energetic, but apparently his message was not, universally taken well, to put it mildly. So, I think he does face that challenge. And the other thing is that when he matches up against a candidate like Romney, Romney is a Republican candidate, who, unlike some of the others from a Democrats or from an independent voter's point of view, is not one of the candidates that some people might think have an arrow through their head, or they're wearing a tinfoil helmet or something. He seems, very reasonable alternative if you're disaffected.
Right, and that's his greatest strength in the general, and perhaps his greatest weakness in the primary.
Yeah, he may be much. It's kind of conventional wisdom, but he's certainly, I think, a much stronger candidate in the general than he is even in the primaries.
Nick, let me ask you this: it seems like the president, since about Labor Day, has been out sort of road testing potential villains. Throws Eric Cantor's name out a lot as somebody who's holding up the works. He seems back to sort of blaming things on lobbyists with some new rules that have come out. What do you make of all that, especially given your high-profile lobbying gig here in Washington?
My take is that things must be really bleak if they're dragging out the old lobbying dog to beat on again. I mean, they've been a little bit quiet on that front, and it's not as if there was some scandal or predicate or any factual basis for this new array of, and frankly, I think, ill-conceived rules that are more for show than for impact. First of all, I can't understand why anybody in the White House would think that it's worth spending one-tenth of a second on tightening up lobbying restrictions instead of the other big problems that are really facing this country. And so I think it's kind of telling that they are, in fact, just test marketing and checking polls, varied messaging, and beating up on lobbyists has worked before for them, so, let's give it a try again. But it's been a part of every presidential campaign since Woodrow Wilson, so it's nothing really new.
Vince, let me come back to you. So I mentioned Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader. The president mentioned him repeatedly out on the campaign trail, sort of an obstructionist in chief of the president's job package. It seems like the president is walking a dangerous line in that he's got these initiatives that he wants Congress to pass, and he needs their cooperation, especially in the House, but he's out on the campaign trail sort of bashing their unwillingness to cooperate with him at all. Does he run the risk of nothing passing, the economy continuing to be bleak, and he gets saddled with that more than congressional Republicans?
I think the way that they're looking at it, Kevin, and I can't speak for them, of course, but my analysis of it is that they see a Congress with the lowest approval rating in history as of yesterday at 13%.
Wouldn't you like to beat that 13%?
Public caning and human cloning is more popular than Congress. So yeah, they're going to run against Congress. I think the trick they have for them to deal with is how do they run around a Democratic-controlled Senate at the same time running against Congress as a whole that is not, it's partly run by their party. So they're going to pick everybody who's low in the polls and run against them, whether it's lobbyists, Congress, China, other people, bankers. That's what they're going to do.
Yeah, very interesting. Nick, what do you think?
I agree. I just agree with what Vince said. It's just what the case, and they've really got a tough time to turn people around. And again, we've not mentioned this, which is astounding, but the single key to the whole deal is the economy and whether something works. And if the economy warms up, it doesn't have to come roaring back, but if it warms up and it looks like, you know, it's going to grow, then I think on balance, people will be reluctant to make a change that might be unsettling. But if it stays in the tank or gets worse, then I think it's going to be a very tough for Democrats in general and the White House and the president in particular. Vince, do you disagree with that?
No, I totally agree. And I think the thing the president does have going for him in this horrible environment is that the numbers, the benchmarks, the hurdles are so low, right? I mean, I think if things look better, right? I mean, you had a month of zero job growth in August. So if you just keep adding some jobs, if they can get something to grow, then they can point in the right direction, so to speak. And
The jobless claims number I saw this morning was flat again, a little over 400,000. So I don't know that there's too many green shoots of optimism coming so far in August.
Let me ask you guys, the only green shoot that could be coming for them, that they're doing well, is they're putting huge pressure on Europe to clean up their act and their banks. And there's going to be a G20 meeting in November where hopefully Europe has cleaned that up. And if they get that done, if they can put enough pressure on Europe to clean that up, that could help turn this, because that is really the greatest story that's weighing down the economy right now, is that the uncertainty flowing across the pond. That is, setting aside our political toxicity and our own issues of housing and everything else, the Europe thing is a big problem right now.
Yeah, that's a very interesting observation. You wonder about the political long-term viability of the EU. Nick, I know you spend a lot of time over there across the pond. What's your sense of how that's all going?
Well, I think there was some good progress made this week with Germany stepping in and Sarkozy backing up and giving some indication that they were not going to tolerate, you know, a meltdown. However, it's not quite responsive to your question, but nevertheless, I'll give it a shot. I was astonished. I was over there in England for about 2 weeks ago, and absolutely every person that I met, whether they were high-ranking Tories or very senior Labor Department people, Labor Party people, or academics at Oxford who follow this stuff in the new Blavatnik School of Government. The question I was receiving was, Obama, it's right, isn't it, that he's going to pull an LBJ and withdraw? And he's not really campaigning wholeheartedly, and so the question is when. And they caught me by surprise. I said, well, he is actually working his tail off campaigning, and every indication is that he's really running. But I don't take the fact of what they said as true or significant. What I take is the significance of the question, and you know, where is it coming from? And they firmly believe it. And plus, that can't be helpful either to us or to them if they feel that there's that kind of, you know, uncertainty.
Yeah, leadership change coming. Well, that's a good place for us to take a break. We're going to be right back after this commercial break to talk some more about current political climate in Washington. Keep it right here.
Thanks, Kevin. Sign it off.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle. Whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on.
Golf. Racing. Or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune into to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The house will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Well, welcome back. We are talking with Vince Verlici about current political conditions. We're talking about the presidential race. Vince, I want to, before we shift to Congress, I want to ask you one more question about the presidential race. Tell me about what your thoughts are as a Democratic strategist about the Herman Cain boomlet.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, here's a gentleman who's got a book and a bus, right? And he's on a tear right now in the polls. He has apparently very little campaign staff, but I do think that he is symbolic of the fact that people, I think, are generally giving up on politicians, and the fact that he's not a politician is really helping him. And as we talked about in the earlier segment, the continued lack of enthusiasm for the presumed front runner that stayed stable for the last number of months for Mitt Romney is, you know, I think it's interesting. Cain's up 22, Perry's down 22. So I think Perry's destruction in the last, self-destruction in the last couple of weeks has been part of this. But it's a boomlet. I don't think it goes that far. I think he's, you know, if Romney wins the presidential, you'd probably see a Secretary Cain over at Commerce kind of thing. But I don't think he's going to be the nominee or the president.
Well, let's shift to Congress for a minute, and we're going to talk about there some of those hot races in a minute, but I want to get your thoughts. We're nearing tomorrow one of the first big deadlines for the super committee process, you know, where committees have a chance to weigh in with potential cuts and revenue raisers. Tell me a little bit. You spent a lot of time in the tax and financial services area on public policy. What's your sense of how the super committee is going and whether or not we're going to see a grand bargain or a small teensy bargain out of the process in 60 days?
Well, I mean, I think it's yet to be seen. I think it's interesting that there's been so much time being spent socializing with each other and getting to know each other in that committee and trying to find a way to work together. I think from the financial services perspective, you know, the investment community assumes that there'll be very little done and maybe even sequestration based on what happened in the summer and the debt ceiling. Sequestration, you know, of course, being the if there's nothing done and they can't come to an agreement and by the end of the year there's automatic cuts across the board in almost every area. I think that I don't hold out hope that there's a grand bargain that they'll come to. I think it'll be an incy-wincy or sequestration.
Yeah, I don't hold out much hope for a grand bargain either. I think there's just too many forces arrayed against them. So as we talk here, I see the South Korean president in a joint news conference with President Obama talking about the newly signed free trade agreement between our two countries that passed Congress yesterday, and he's going to have a joint to address a joint session of Congress later today. Tell us a little bit about how you think those free trade agreements might help both the president and the Democratic Party's attempts to hold on to power in the Senate and regain it in the House.
Well, I don't think there's a ton of connection. I think when it comes to politics, it's probably the first example we've seen all year of some bipartisan activity in this town, frankly, doing anything that isn't keeping the government alive, right? And so I think I think it might help all of the incumbents, because maybe the American people see for a couple of days that they did something. But, you know, I think that these trade agreements to most people are seen pretty inconsequential, except in some states where, like in Washington or other, Washington State or in California, where maybe there are closer connections with Asia and there's more trade that's done, and there's frankly larger communities. So I don't hold out a lot of significance in these at all, other than maybe that it increases the visibility for just a moment here that things can get done in this town still. And frankly, it's a good thing for our economy. The relationship that we have with South Korea is probably one of the most important ones in Asia for a lot of reasons.
Right.
And so I think it's a good thing.
Well, let's talk about the Senate. Tell me, we've got a 53-47 Democratic majority over there. I saw Chuck Schumer leading a Senate Democrat quoted yesterday saying that even though they've got 23 Democratic-held seats that are up for election in 2012, he believes they will hold the majority after this. Republicans are extraordinarily confident that regardless of the presidential election, they're going to retake the Senate and hold the House. Give me your two cents on all that.
Well, yeah, so I was looking at the races again this morning, and many people who follow this, if you don't, there's 23 Democrats that are up in 2012, and there's 10 Republicans that are up. The Democratic number is just mammoth, and this is an outgrowth of the fact that you had so many Democrats that won, mostly for the first time, in 2006, and this was
right
on the heels of the Iraq War being so unpopular, and the President Bush's last midterm.
The tide comes in, but is it about to go out?
Well, maybe, but I do think that if you look at these, 15 of the 23 Democrats are pretty safe, and they're in safe blue seats. From Feinstein to Cantwell to even I would say Sherrod Brown in Ohio is running quite a campaign. So the question really comes down to the toss-ups, which is Missouri, Montana, Nebraska,
Virginia, Florida,
and New Mexico, West Virginia, Wisconsin. So I think that the going back to the presidential conversation, what those toss-ups have in their advantage is that number again. You got a president who's raising huge sums of money that will be used in these same states because the president's going to need to participate heavily in trying to win states like Senator McCaskill's Missouri,
Virginia,
Senator, the open seat in New Mexico, right, and the Virginia Senate seat. So those candidates like Kaine and others will benefit from the presidential money even if he were to lose those states. So I think if you assume that that you hold those swing states that are toss-up Senate seats, that leaves you with the question of how does Senator Tester in Montana, Senator Nelson of Nebraska, and Senator Manchin of West Virginia do? And if you were to lose a couple of those, but yet maybe pick up one or two, you've got an extremely competitive seat. Senator Brown of Massachusetts is in a tough race right now. And then you've got an appointed new incumbent in Nevada, Senator Heller, who replaced Senator Ensign, and you've got a strongly supported Congresswoman Shelley Berkley by Senator Reid. You know, I think looking at the map today, I don't think this is what the country needs right now, everything we've seen in the last year, but I could see a 50-50 Senate here. You could see
Wouldn't that be fascinating? Well, you see
three Dems lose, and then you've got Joe Biden up there breaking the tie, and you have what you had for a couple years back in, 2002?
Yeah, you got a power-sharing agreement. Well,
yeah.
Let me hit this Massachusetts race, because Scott Brown, came to town sort of on the front edge of the Republican Tea Party wave in 2010, and he's raised a ton of money. Now you've got consumer advocate Elizabeth Warren, who's gotten into the race. She has blown away all expectations, raising $3 million in less than a quarter's worth of time. And now you've seen, I think, two fairly decent-sized mistakes by Scott Brown's campaign in just the last week. What's happening there?
I mean, look, Massachusetts is what? It's a plus-20 Democratic state. You've got a You've got a well-known candidate. And I think the most significant thing that's happening that people may not be thinking about is that some of the disenchantment with your online donors, right, the most liberal of the donors that participate in politics by both reading about it and donating online in small amounts, I think that some of those folks that are disenchanted with the president are probably channeling their time and funds to Elizabeth Warren, because there's someone that they can, you know, a new candidate that they believe is more aligned with them,
right,
more strident on issues they care about, being anti-Wall Street. And so I think, you know, she might be a beneficiary of that. And I mean, listen, $3 million out the gate, that's a great number for the first few weeks. But you know, these campaigns are long. You have to sustain this. That will be an extremely, extremely closely watched race. And that's the kind of race, even with the Democratic voting advantage that Warren would have. Anybody who says something ridiculous, and there's a long time to say something ridiculous, could trip themselves up.
Yeah.
And that thing could go back and forth here.
I want to go to Ohio, because you said, you know, you think Sherrod Brown's running a great race there. I think Republicans feel like they've got a lot of confidence in Josh Mandel, a state treasurer who's a young guy, war veteran, has obviously experience running statewide. And he raised an eye-popping amount of money last quarter during the summer. We haven't seen his third quarter numbers yet. But he outraised Senator Brown, which is a fairly impressive feat for a guy running in a contested primary against an incumbent.
Sure. And again, I mean, the first couple of quarters are always going to be big quarters for new candidates, because you have a lot of enthusiastic money. The question is, can they replicate it? And an incumbent has huge advantages. Now, I think the unique thing for Senator Brown in Ohio that he has going for him is Governor Kasich. I think he's been so strident, and I think whether you agree or disagree with what he's doing, I think his strident type of demeanor, and combined with his decision making, has really brought the base up, raised their dander, right? The public employee unions and such.
Yep.
That will help Senator Brown, not by his own doing, although Senator Brown's probably fully in line with them anyway on a number of most of the issues. But I think that he will benefit from some of the anger within the base, whereas you see a lot of other states where the base is a little tamped down and depressed about sort of, you know, lost hope with the president a little bit, right, on a number of things. So, these are unique. Each state is unique, as we've talked about so far. And I think, again, we got a year to go. It could be a national election that sweeps away these unique features, but nonetheless,
Senate always breaks one way or another.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, 6 years ago broke hard left, and we'll see where it breaks 13 months from now. Real quick, I got about a minute left, Vince. Forecast on the House election a year out.
I think the Republicans hold the House, and I think that they, depending on how this presidential campaign goes, you know, I don't think it moves much. I mean, they've done such a great job redistricting with their control they've gotten in a number of states and the state legislatures and the maps they control, that they will probably just break even in a bad year for them, but they'll probably gain seats.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, we've been joined by Vince Ferlicci of Patton Boggs talking about all things election 2012. We're going to be back in just a minute to talk a little bit about the area of computer data privacy. Keep it here on Capital Thinking.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjoy Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjoy Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattenboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattenboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. We're going to shift gears away from politics and get into some substantive law here for this segment, talk a little bit about computer data privacy issues. And our guest comes from the Dallas area. It's Sean Tuma, an attorney there with a great deal of experience in the data privacy computer fraud area. In fact, he's the author, editor of a substantial blog on this topic, the Computer Data Privacy Law blog. So, Sean, welcome to Capital Thinking, and tell us a little bit about how somebody in this area runs their practice these days.
Thank you very much, Kevin. I appreciate the opportunity to participate in the program. The way to run the practice these days probably begins first and foremost with being proactive. Data issues, data security issues are leading the headlines right now. This has been called the year of the hack. Every company is susceptible to having their data breached and manipulated and stolen. And therefore, someone like me, I try to be proactive in advising clients on how they can avoid these kind of problems, on setting up systems, checking their insurance needs, things of that nature. And then whenever, unfortunately, if they have problems with these issues, then that's when my litigation background comes in handy and we step in to try to solve the problem or do that for clients that come in that already have those problems.
Nice. Well, hopefully your blog hasn't been hacked, but tell me a little bit about what led you to start the Computer Data Privacy Law blog and what one can find out there.
Kevin, I'm knocking on wood right now. As we say, it hasn't been hacked because, to my knowledge, it hasn't been hacked, and that's something that I may never know. I may not see sometimes what happens that that doesn't manifest itself. But I started the blog because the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is the real core of the blog, and it's something I have a great deal of passion about. And I've recently written a substantial law review article that's getting published by the South Carolina Law Review. And in the process of writing that, I've literally read all of the legislative history on this Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, all of the appellate opinions, and far too many district court opinions to even mention. And I decided as long as I was doing that, I may as well blog about it and to share that information with others and to have a record of it myself so that I would be able to refer back to it when I need to. And that's really how the blog got started.
Interesting. And tell me a little bit, I'm not very familiar with the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, so tell me a little bit about when that law was passed and what some of the key elements are.
Well, it was passed. It came about back in 1984. And I don't know if you recall the movie War Games.
Absolutely. Matthew Broderick, Ali Sheedy, come on.
Absolutely. Well, that created a hacking hysteria throughout the nation. And, of course, Congress, doing what Congress has to do, it has to act. And so they went into action to create a law back then that it wasn't called the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act until 1986, but they first enacted it in 1984. And it was a criminal law when it was first passed, and it was later amended to include civil remedies, which is more the area that I focus on, is the civil aspects of it. But, excuse me, it generally, and this is a gross oversimplification, but it prohibits someone from wrongfully accessing a computer to do something bad. And it's a two core elements that go to it. One is, what is a wrongful access? And it can be a wrongful access by having someone that's either external, like a traditional hacker, accessing a company's computer system without any authorization whatsoever. And this is what we've seen a lot of in the news lately. Or yeah, it can be internal.
Tell me a little bit about that, Sean. I mean, you mentioned War Games. You're going back, I think that's a quarter century old movie at this point. So tell me about some of these things that are in the news that are, really implicate the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
Well, one of the most popular is what we've seen this past year, and it made national headlines all over the place, which was the Lulz and Anonymous hacking spree that was, running rampant all over the nation up until early part of the summer. And that's a classic example of a hacking when someone who's external to an organization goes in and takes data, out of the organization itself with having no rights to be there. And then the other side of that is the internal breaches, which is actually the more common. These are things such as employees taking trade secret lists, company data, things of that nature. And that's what we see most of the cases about these days.
Well, tell me, you mentioned earlier you've got an article coming out in the South Carolina Law Review. Why don't you delve into a little bit about what the subject of the article is and what some of the key points you'll be making in that article?
The subject of the article, it's called What is the CFAA and Why Should I Care? A Primer on the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act for Civil Litigators. And the reason I decided to write that article is because computers have become such a common part of our society now, and virtually every business case is going to have computer issues involved. And so many lawyers do not realize that this law is out there, and it was basically to give practicing attorneys an idea of why they needed to know this because of the dominance of computers in society, and second, to just give them an overview of how to use it in the most common cases, such as like a treatise or a practice guide, just to say, here are the most common issues you face, this is how you deal with them, this is what the law is, and at least give a good starting point.
What do you see as sort of the most common mistakes practitioners make, or companies that are involved in these types of attacks? What are the most common mistakes they make in sort of defending their rights, or attorneys in defending these cases?
This one is, there is no doubt on this issue. It is the $5,000 loss requirement that is required for a civil remedy under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. In most business cases, it's a jurisdictional threshold. Unless you meet that requirement, the court does not even have jurisdiction to hear the case. So it's very important that attorneys understand how to plead that, and a lot don't, because it's very, very complex, and the statute has numerous cross references and incorporates other provisions, and even things like damage and damages, both terms are used in that provision, and they don't mean the same thing, and they don't mean a loss. And so what you have is, in essence, it's not a, if you understand the statute, it's not terribly difficult to do. So that's why I wrote the, I've got an upcoming article in the Texas Lawyer that addresses that issue on basically three steps on how to meet the loss requirement. And what it comes down to is a loss is a cost. It's a cost to investigate, respond, or remedy the damage. It does not go to the value of the case. In many cases, I've seen multi-million-dollar cases where the attorneys had plenty of damages, but they didn't meet the loss requirement, and the case got dismissed.
Interesting. Well, walk us through the other three elements there that you were talking about in that article.
Well, the first thing is what I recommend is that an attorney be involved at the very beginning of the process, that you have the attorney come in to lead the investigation, because under some court cases, and the jurisdictions are not settled on this, but in some cases the courts will permit the attorney's fees for the investigation to go towards the cost under the loss. So obviously you want that included if you get it. The second is you need to get a licensed computer forensics examiner to get in to secure the evidence before anybody goes tinkering with it. You know how people have a tendency when they see something's happened on their computer, especially if they know a little bit about computers, they want to go in, they want to try to figure out the problem. This is the worst thing you can do because it taints the evidence, and therefore it makes it unusable and sometimes inadmissible. And so for me, I have a like a partnering relationship with a great computer forensics firm here in town that it, within a minute's notice, I can pick up the phone, call them, and they'll get someone to secure that data nationwide. And then the second thing, or the third thing, is they have to actually go in and spend some time and spend some money to reach that $5,000 value in the investigation part, in the remediation part, you know, in restoring the data, not necessarily the damages, but the data to its prior condition. And if you can do that, you satisfy the $5,000 loss requirement.
Interesting, interesting. Well, tell us, I got about a minute left, tell us a little bit about the blog, where we can find it, and what the latest and greatest writings on there are today.
Well, the blog is at seanetuma.com. It's www.seanetuma.com. And it has, most of the writings are by me, but thanks to our good friend Cordell Parvin, who has suggested that I bring on some guest bloggers, I'm trying to get other people to come in and write. And Kevin, I know you've got plenty of spare time, so if you want to come in and write a guest blog, please feel free to do so. And I've written recently about issues such as whether you can hack a car, and I think you can, and whether companies are going to get hit for some of these data breach cases one day in a similar way that we saw with the Ford Pinto back in the 70s, where they're going to get sent a message.
Well, I only blog about things I know about. I don't know anything about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, so I'm going to have to pass on that offer. We're going to wrap things up. If you want more info, hit Sean up at Sean E. Tuma. That's SHAWNETUMA.com, and you can read all about his computer data privacy law blog there. We're going to be back in just a minute to talk about healthcare reform here on Capital Thinking.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street, to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to the show, everybody. We're going to talk a little bit about health care reform and what's going on with that with one of our favorite guests, Julie Black, who runs the Capital Thinking Healthcare blog. Julie, welcome back. And the Super Committee, big deadline tomorrow. Tell us a little bit about what the Super Committee is thinking in the healthcare arena.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me back. And actually, I think it's interesting. Politico had a great article about the workings of the Super Committee, and I think they summarized it nicely when they said the first rule of the Super Committee, its members don't talk about the Super Committee. So,
it's like Fight
strangely,
Club.
Yeah, like Fight Club. Strangely enough, this committee and its members and the staff have been pretty tight-lipped, which I think, as you know, in Washington is pretty unusual. We do understand that the Super Committee continues to meet, and those meetings are held behind closed doors. We also understand that they're being briefed by Congressional Budget Office staff, budget experts, and other policy gurus. And the intent there is to establish a baseline understanding of federal programs. As you know, there's a diversity on the committee in terms of issue areas and committee representation, and so in areas like Medicare, there's a dispersed view or knowledge base, and so they're trying to get everyone up to speed. We also understand that they're being briefed on previous deficit reduction recommendations that have been proposed by other commissions and working groups. But you're right. Tomorrow is one of the big deadlines for the House and Senate committees to send their recommendations to the Super Committee. And this week, we've started to see letters percolate, one from the House Energy and Commerce Committee Democrats, another from Senator Herb Cole, a Democrat of Wisconsin, and then also from Senator Tom Harkin, who is the chairman of the HELP Committee. And it's interesting because the House Energy and Commerce Committee Democrats actually noted that their proposal for savings would cost money up front to the tune of $16 billion. But that would generate nearly 600,000 jobs. In the long term, they estimate that their proposal would save to the tune of $150 billion over 10 years. And in particular, in terms of healthcare, they advocate for continued implementation of the Affordable Care Act. They want to see the sustainable growth rate formula replaced with a different payment mechanism. And they also advocate for extending a number of expiring Medicare provisions. One of those is the therapy caps exceptions process. The committee also discussed in its letter the importance of the Prevention and Public Health Fund, which was established in the Affordable Care Act, and they recommend adoption of legislation which would limit pay-for-delay arrangements which would delay the entry of generic drugs into the marketplace.
Interesting. Well, you mentioned among that long litany there, the Medicare physician payment issue, and, you know, seems like the doc fix is a perennial cause celeb up on the Hill, and we're getting close to the end of the year, and at that point in time, we'll see almost a 30% cut in Medicare payments to physicians. So is that something that is going to be tacked on to the super committee's jurisdiction, or is that something that will have to be handled separately?
Well, I think we're seeing a case of Groundhog Day again here. Given the cost of a permanent fix, which is estimated to be about $300 billion, I don't think the super committee is going to address it. They may have discussions about whether they want to address it, but I really think their task and scope is pretty large already, and I'm not sure that they want to play in this space. What's interesting, though, is that the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, which is known as MedPAC, held a public meeting just last week, and they focused on repealing the SGR formula. The commissioners actually overwhelmingly voted in favor of replacing the SGR, which is not unusual for them. What's unusual is that they actually developed a mechanism to replace the SGR with. So what they recommend is a 10-year path of fee schedule updates, which would take the current Medicare payment rates for primary care and freeze them, and then other physician services would be subject to a 5.9% payment cut for 3 years, followed by a 7-year payment freeze. The other thing that was unusual about MedPAC's dealings with SGR repeal and replacement is that after the Commission's September 2011 meeting, MedPAC offered a potential list of Medicare offsets to pay for the cost of repealing SGR. They talked a little bit about the list at their October meeting, and staff in particular emphasized that the potential list was no way endorsed by MedPAC, but it was just sort of their thinking. Some of the policies were recommended by MedPAC. Others were a compilation of offsets generated from other commissioners or commissions or working groups.
Interesting. Chairman, go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you,
Julie. Well, I was just going to say that Chairman Glenn Hathbark explained a little bit about why MedPAC at this juncture is doing a little bit more than what they usually do. And he said that given the size and scope of the SGR, given that this is something that Congress perennially deals with, that MedPAC really felt an obligation to advise Congress more than just saying repeal SGR, but to provide a solution to a problem that's not gone away. So maybe Congress will take them up on their offer and use the solution that they recommended. But I'm not sure that it will happen this year.
I got about 2 minutes left.
Sure.
Last time you were on, we talked a little bit about rule implementation from the Affordable Care Act. Catch me up on what the latest is over at Health and Human Services on rolling those things out.
Sure. Well, I think we had some excitement last week. In addition to the MedPAC meeting, the Institute of Medicine issued its recommendations to the Department of Health and Human Services regarding the criteria and methods for determining and updating the essential health benefits package. This is important because all plans that are offered in the exchange will be required to have these essential health benefits. They, again, did not recommend the benefits per se, but simply the criteria, or not so simply according to their report. But really what they did is emphasize that the benefit should not be so robust that premium costs are driven up for beneficiaries, but they need to have some baseline. Really, they, in terms of criteria, recommended that the essential health benefits should be subjected to evidence-based review or cost analysis. And they also indicated that the definition of essential health benefits should be one that would be typical in a small employer market. So again, I think they're trying to recommend walking a fine line between having a healthy amount of benefits but not so many that there's a significant cost involved.
Well, we're going to wrap things up there. Julie Black from CapitalThinkingHealthcare.com blog. You can check her out there. We're going to be back next week with more Capital Thinking. Until then, I hope everyone has a great weekend.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.